nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Let's get started with part two, okay? We had DFT in 50 minutes. Now we're going to have MD in 50 minutes, all right? So, I'm caffeinated so we can keep going. So, what we're solving now is F equals MA, okay? And this force comes, as we said earlier, from the derivative of a potential. And that potential can come from ab initio calculations, okay? DFT gives you the total energy of that system. Again, if we're all atoms, we all sit still, we solve for the electrons, okay? That has an energy. If I move a little bit to my right, the energy changes. I can take that derivative, right? And that tells me the force that's acting on myself, okay? So that's a force. If I know force, I can solve F equals ma. So you have F equals ma, you have it written in Hamilton's form on the right, and that's it. So the energy can come from ab initio calculations, that's called ab initio molecular dynamics, but it can also come from what are called empirical force fields or interatomic potentials that basically give you an expression for that energy as a function of atomic positions. That does not involve solving the electronic structure calculation. More direct, maybe an analytical expression for that term. Okay? So let's talk about the approximations. The fact that we're solving F equals ma for the ions is an approximation. We're not doing quantum dynamics. Okay? Now, ions are much heavier than electrons, and that's why they're more classical. Okay? They're bigger objects. And so we can get away with using the same equations we use to do, you know, to solve the moon orbiting around the Earth or to put, the shadow in orbit. It's the exact same equation that we use to see how atoms move. Okay? So it's pretty impressive. But it is an approximation. We're going to talk in a bit about when that approximation breaks down, because it does break down. And the other big approximation is your potential energy, okay? So if your potential energy expression is not accurate enough, your forces are going to be wrong, your results are going to be wrong. That's true even if you do ab initio calculations, right? So even if you do ab initio MD, we were talking about the fact that we made approximations in DFT to get to the DFT equations. We're not solving the Schrödinger equation in 3N dimensional space. We're solving this simplified equations with an exchange of correlation functional that we don't know and we approximate. And so the result is, even then, it's not perfect. You know, there's a bit of, it's off a little bit. We said bond distances by a few percent or so. Yes.
Just to clarify the terminology, E here is the energy of the system or energy of a specific electron.
E is the potential energy of everything in the system. And that includes, so classically you think about as the total energy. So it's the total energy of the system minus the kinetic energy of the ions. It includes the kinetic energy of the electrons, right? It includes the electron-electron interaction. It includes the electron-ion interaction and the ion-ion interaction. Everything except for the kinetic energy of the ions, because that we're doing explicitly, right? We have that. Okay? Does that make sense? That energy is what comes out of DFT. If you use a DFT code, you put atomic positions, you get an energy. That energy is that E over there. Okay? All right. So Hamilton reformulated Newtonian dynamics, okay, in the 1800s. He defined a function called the Hamiltonian. Okay, we talked about Hamiltonian in the ab initio section. It's the total energy operator in ab initio. Here's the function of the total energy. It has the kinetic energy. So I'm going to switch here nomenclature, okay? So I'm going to call V the total potential energy. That used to be our E, okay, from the Schrödinger equation, okay? But now it's not the total energy, it's V because it's potential energy, and I also have the kinetic energy of the ions, okay? So that's the second term in the equation. Fine. From this Hamiltonian function, you can derive equations of motion, okay? The time derivative of the position, R sub I, is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the conjugate momentum, okay? And the time derivative of the momentum P sub I is negative the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the conjugate position. So this is nothing more than F equals ma written in Hamilton's form, okay, which has some advantages. So the one on the left, R dot is V, then P dot is force over mass, such as force. So now these equations can only be solved analytically for very, very few systems, okay, like a spring attached to a mass attached to a spring, or a two-body problem, you know, the moon orbiting around the Earth. You can solve those analytically with pen and pencil, but if you have three bodies, there's no analytical solution. So we have to use a computer to simulate these equations, okay? And as we said, people have run trillion atom MD simulations on the biggest computers in the world. More typical simulation involved between million and a billion atoms, okay? So reasonably large simulations. So now there's some things that are conserved in Hamiltonian dynamics, and I apologize, but I'm going to use the board here just to give you a flavor of how it works out. They have the Hamiltonian written there. The time derivative of the Hamiltonian, I can write as a sum over all my coordinates. It goes from 1 to 3n. It's x, y, z for every single atom. And I have the partial derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the position times r dot plus the partial derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the momentum times p dot, right? Now, if you remember from our equations of motion, r dot, so the time derivative of the Hamiltonian, I have this sum, I have the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to r sub I times r dot. Now, r dot from the equation of motion is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p sub I, right? And then I have plus, the second term is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p sub I times p dot. Now, p dot is negative the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to r sub I. So I have negative.
Red or black?
I don't have red. Oh, I do have red. That's the end anyway. So that's zero. Okay? So the total energy, the Hamiltonian is a constant of motion, okay? If I solve the Hamiltonian, if I solve F equals ma, the total energy, because the forces come from as the gradient of a potential, the total energy is conserved. It's a constant of motion. There are others. Linear momentum is a constant of motion. Angular momentum is a constant of motion. Things that are conserved as I solve these equations. That is very practical uses when you do MD simulations. Okay. Now, so in very simple terms, the structure of an MD code looks something like this. Okay. At the very beginning, what I have is I start with initial conditions. I decide where at time zero, where my atoms will be and my velocities for all my atoms will be. And with those, I'm going to calculate the forces given the atomic positions. And if I know the force, And if I know the position, I know the velocity, I know the force, I can predict the future. Okay, I can use the equations of motion, Newton's equations of motion, to tell me what the next position will be, what the next velocity will be. So all of us look around, calculate our forces. With the forces, with the velocities, we move the positions. With the forces, we move our velocities. And we all take a little step. Then we look around and we recalculate the forces, which are new because we've all moved. And then we take another little step, and another little step, and another little step. And that's doing molecular dynamics. Okay? So you move the, you advance the positions and the velocities, recalculate forces, advance position and velocities, recalculate forces, and do this loop over and over and over until you've reached the end of the simulation. That's MD. Every now and then you write outputs, you write your stuff and whatnot. So the idea is very simple. Although coming up with it wasn't that simple, and the meaning of it wasn't very simple. And so let's do a simple simulation. Okay, let me show you a simple animation. So this is a block, a very tiny piece of aluminum in this case. And maybe if I can... well, you can sit. It's not great, but you can sit. So what do you think is happening? It's vibrating. What's happening with the vibrations? It's increasing, right? So what do you think will happen in a little bit?
Might start to the orderness might start to.
The order, yeah, the order is going to be lost, right? So let's keep looking. All right, so what happened to it? It melted. It turned into a liquid, right? It melted. You can see that when it melted, actually the volume increased very quickly, right? And so that's what happened. Now, the reason why this looks square is because we use periodic boundary conditions, okay, not because liquids, this is not a droplet, but it's a tiny piece of bulk. But the bottom line, okay, which is a non-trivial thing to understand, is that all of this was predicted entirely by the expression of the potential energy as a function of positions, and by the fact that we're using classical molecular dynamics. I did not tell the system you have to melt at this point. Okay? I did not tell the system how to melt or where to melt or whether to melt or not. I didn't tell the system that it should be an FCC crystal when it was a solid, and I didn't tell what structure the liquid should have. All of that stuff comes from the simulation. There's no other input other than the potential and the fact that we use classical dynamics. Okay, that's the only input that we give. Question?
So, in the crystal, how do you run it backwards?
Yes, if you cool it down, you can try many crystal structures. Of course, these potentials are parameterized knowing that the ground state should be what it should be. But yes, if you cool it down, it will recrystallize into FCC. Absolutely true.
So it looked like the total energy was not a constant.
No. I was heating it up from outside. So we were providing energy from outside. Someone called this global warming. We're slowly heating it up at some rate, okay? It's extremely fast rate. And that's true. Yeah, that's from outside. It's similar to what you do in a lab.
How are you heating it up?
That's why we have an hour to go. So you'll have to let me let me answer. Okay. Does that make sense? Now, so I do this. Okay. So yeah, quite.
If we do not heat, just we let them to make new structure or new lattice.
So if I run it at, say, 300 Kelvin at room temperature, I can run it for as long as I want, and it's going to be a very boring moving with the atoms doing this back and forth. Right, because that's the crystal, it's in the ground state. So all it will do is oscillate around its position. If I could wait, you know, years, maybe some atom will create a defect, you know, create a vacancy interstitial pair or something like that. But the timescales for that are huge at room temperature.
Do you really think that it was the ground state?
That was the ground state. Yeah, when we started, it was the ground state. It's FCC, phase center cubic. Okay? So it would stay there with these little vibrations forever.
I just thought there can be another lot of times, for example, triangle or...
Yeah, so... But we know it's not, right? So when we parameterize these potentials, we go through every possible single crystal structure that you can imagine and make sure that we actually, the ground state is the lower energy one. So if your potential is wrong, that's actually a good point. Okay, let me answer this. So let's say I want to do iron. Okay, iron is FCC, is BCC. So if I have a Cramé potential for iron and I build the FCC lattice, and I start running, and the potential really prefers FCC, it might actually transform, right? I can't keep it there if it doesn't want to stay there. If it wants to go somewhere else, it's going to go somewhere else. Okay, I don't tell it what crystal structure to have. Okay, now, so let's say I have this simulation. What would you like to learn out of this simulation? What's that? Latent heat. That's a good question. That's a good thing to learn. Yeah, it's how much energy you spend melting. What other, maybe simpler? The melting temperature, right? That's another thing. So you can imagine that I want to learn the melting temperature. Right? I want someone to tell me, well, this is aluminum. It should melt around 960, you know, Kelvin or so. I would not be very interested in someone publishing a paper saying, well, when this melted, atom 34 was at this position, and atom 35 was at this position, and atom 30, that's, you know, it's not very interesting. It's just too much information. So in order to understand MD, I need to have a way of communicating the microscopic world and the macroscopic world. Okay? I need to be able to find a way to connect microscopic things, you know, the theory knows about atoms and velocity, positions and velocities. It doesn't know about temperature. Someone with some theory, we need to be able to extract temperature from this microscopic thing. Okay, the MD simulation, all it knows is the position and the velocity of every atom as a function of time. And so the theory that does that is StatMech. Statistical mechanics give you a link between the microscopic world and the macroscopic world. And what we'd like to know is, given a thermodynamic state, what is a microscopic configuration consistent with that thermodynamic state, and vice versa. If I have a series of microscopic states, what is the macroscopic state that corresponds to that description? Okay? So in order to understand and to design MD simulations, you need to know a little bit of StatMech. So let's talk a little bit about StatMech very briefly so that we can chat about the rest of the presentation. So in thermodynamics, okay, we talk, and in statistical mechanics, we talk about all these different ensembles, okay? Different ensembles correspond to different conditions, you know, external conditions to which you subject your system. So the microcanonical ensemble, or NVE, is an ensemble where your system is isolated from the rest of the world. It has constant number of particles, constant volume, and constant energy. Nothing comes in or out, nor energy, no nothing. In the canonical ensemble, instead of having constant energy, you have walls that exchange heat with the rest of the world, with the universe. So you have constant temperature instead of constant energy. Does that make sense? The bath sets the temperature to your system. And the isobaric isothermal ensemble, you have constant pressure instead of constant volume. So your walls can move. So your pressure inside is the same as the pressure outside. Okay? In all of these ensembles, You have probability distribution functions, okay? You have the probability of a given configuration, atomistic configuration, that's consistent with that overall constraint. And we all know about Maxwell-Boltzmann, okay? So in the canonical ensemble, the probability of a microscopic configuration with positions r sub I and velocities p sub, momenta p sub I is proportional to the e to the negative, the energy corresponding to that state divided by k over t, by kt. Okay? Does that make sense? It's Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. In the microcanonical ensemble, when you have a system that's isolated, it's a very interesting thing. Every single configuration that's consistent with that constraint, okay, that has the energy, is equally likely. Okay? And you can derive the entire StatMech book, including the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, by making that assumption. That's the most fundamental assumption that you make. It's equal a priori probabilities. Any configuration is equally likely. All the rest comes from that. Okay, so you have a distribution. You have what's called a partition function. So in microcanonical ensemble, it's the volume, okay, the number of states that are consistent with the total energy and volume and number of particles. And then that's StatMech, the connection to thermodynamics is a relationship between these integrals over space, the partition functions, and a thermodynamic potential. Okay? So we all know in the microcanonical ensemble, the number of states is related to entropy. K log the number of states is the entropy. Entropy is a macroscopic thermodynamic quantity. The number of states, omega, is something that I can calculate from atomistics, you know, from the microscopic world. In the canonical ensemble, it's the Helmholtz free energy. That's negative KT log of Z. Z is this partition function. It's the same thing as the number of states. Okay? So, this is not just MD in half an hour. This is StatMech in 10 minutes. So, this is more challenging. But that's kind of the idea. There's a connection between the, and you all obviously use this, a lot of this concept. So, there's a connection between the microscopic world and thermodynamics that's through StatMech. Okay? So by the way, if you go to Vienna, you can go to the Central Cemetery and Boltzmann is buried there. And in his grave, you see S equals K log omega. Okay, so you can go there, take a look. And so all right. Okay, let me go through this kind of quickly. Why is this important? Okay. Let's talk about one result from StatMech that's very important in molecular dynamics. Let's say, so I have my Hamiltonian. I want to calculate an equilibrium value. So I'm going to write again here. Sorry, Joe, about that. So similar to quantum mechanics, if I want to calculate an average value of a property, what I have to do is integrate over all my positions and all my momenta of the property that depends on the positions and the momenta. This could be a stress or an energy or what have you, times the probability. So if you're in the canonical ensemble, it's e to the negative beta, the Hamiltonian of that configuration. And there's a normalization constant here called Z. Does that make sense? So if I want to calculate an average of any property, I integrate over all possible states of that property times the probability of that state. Pretty straightforward. Now there's an interesting result. So suppose your Hamiltonian depends on one of its variables. One of the variables appears in the Hamiltonian squared, and that's the only time it appears in the Hamiltonian. Okay? Like the momenta. You know, momenta appears in the Hamiltonian square, it appears just one time. Each momenta appears p squared just one time in the Hamiltonian. So if you plug that in, if you do that calculation of the mean value of that energy term, of that term, the mean value of lambda times pi p1 squared, and you do a little bit of math that I will skip, what you get is that, and this is an interesting result, every variable that appears squared in the Hamiltonian contributes 1/2 of kT to the energy, no matter what the prefactor is, no matter what lambda is. Okay? Can do the math, it's two lines, trivial. That's called the theorem of equipartition of energy. Any variable that appears squared in the Hamiltonian contributes 1/2 of kT, no matter what. So, every particle, its kinetic energy is p squared over 2m. Regardless of what the mass is, in average, each of those particles contribute 1/2, each of those variables contribute 1/2 of kT. So per particle, 3/2 kT, okay, of energy. So that gives me a direct relationship between the average kinetic energy and temperature, the thermodynamic quantity. So you probably all know this. This is the origin of why temperature is proportional to the kinetic energy per degree of freedom, okay? So this is used quite a bit in molecular dynamics. That's the relationship. Average kinetic energy is 3n over 2 kT, right? 3n is, n is the number of particles, and 3 is because we live in three-dimensional space. So I have 3n momenta that appear squared in the Hamiltonian. Each of them contribute 1/2 kT. When you do MD, typically you have your center of mass is not moving, so you have to subtract 3 degrees of freedom that don't have any energy and you don't have rotations, so you end up with 3n minus 6/2 of kT as the average kinetic energy. So every code, every MD code that you use will have implemented something like this that would allow you, for example, from the run that we did, the global warming run, to tell you what temperature the system had when it melted. Does that make sense? That was the question we wanted to answer. Like temperature, there are many other results from STAT-MEC that are very useful in molecular dynamics. The fluctuations, not just the mean value, so temperature is related to mean kinetic energy. Fluctuations also relate to physical properties, okay? Fluctuations of energy under constant temperature have to do with specific heat. Fluctuations of volume under constant pressure have to do with the compressibility of the material, okay? So looking at mean properties, mean values, and fluctuations during a dynamical microscopic simulation tell you about response functions from thermodynamics. Okay, so you can make those connections. All right, questions so far? Let's talk about,
So if you, in fluctuation dissipation theorem, we kind of say that we don't need to know exactly what the noise source is, but if we know the resistance or dissipation and initial kinetic energy. So when you do DFT, does that arise naturally? Like if you don't use fluctuation dissipation theorem, but you have some kind of intrinsic loss in
Yes. With MD, not DFT, you do. So there are actually some techniques, for example, to look at transport that make use of losses in the numerical noise in the integration, to get through fluctuation dissipation into response functions. And these results are fluctuation dissipation, results. Okay. So we use them all the time. There's some techniques that may make use of them explicitly. All right. Let's talk about quantum effects. Okay. When F equals MA breaks down. So this is a schematic interatomic potential between two atoms. Okay. So let's say I have oxygen too, an oxygen molecule, and have these two atoms vibrating with respect to one another at some temperature. So if I have a relatively high temperature, my oscillation, right, is going to go back and forth at that potential well between, the, say, those two limits, you know, and that's the kinetic energy that I have. Fine. So as I decrease the temperature, the fluctuation, the oscillation is going to be less and less, right? Because I have less kinetic energy. Remember, temperature is kinetic energy. If I keep reducing the temperature, lower. When I get to zero temperature is no kinetic energy, zero velocity. So the two atoms are at the bottom of the well. Okay? So who would be very unhappy with this situation? A very famous physicist. Not you, not the. you can be unhappy too, but. Einstein would also, but he has a name. Heisenberg, right? It's the uncertainty principle. Does that make sense? In that situation, we know both the position and the velocity of the atoms with infinite precision, right? And the uncertainty principle tells you you cannot. So classical dynamics has no problem with that solution. You know, Newton is perfectly happy with this solution. People in this room, not so happy. Heisenberg, not so happy. And that's the issue. So if, at very, very low temperatures, your system, quantum effects will manifest in the system, and F equals ma breaks down. So all MD simulations break down eventually at some temperature, when your temperature is very low. The limit, typically the way you do this is with the device temperature, right? So basically if KT, so the kinetic energy is large with respect to H bar omega, which is the quantum of energy of that harmonic oscillator at the bottom, then you're okay. You're in a classical regime. When the temperature is lower than the H bar omega, the frequency times Planck's constant of the oscillator, then you have quantum effects because you're contracting you're knowing too much about the position of the atom. Does that make sense? So eventually, all of this breaks down. So more reading about stat-mech. And then we're going to use this little schematic representation of a pseudocode of an MD code to go into some of the details of MD simulations. We're going to talk about first the integration of the equations of motion. Okay, so how do we solve F equals ma numerically? Okay? And so let's start with these two equations. P dot. So we have R dot equals P over M, right? So I have P sub I over M is equal to R dot. So R dot, I'm going to approximate as R at T plus delta minus R at T over delta. Does that make sense? So from this equation, I can predict the future, right? R at T plus delta equals R at T plus P over M at T times delta, right? I can do the exact same procedure with the bottom equation, and I can predict P at T plus delta. It's P at T plus force at T plus delta. Does that make sense? So if I know my position at time t, my velocity at time t, and my force at time t, I can predict the future. I can predict the velocity, and the positions of all my atoms at time t plus delta, a little bit ahead in time. Then I recalculate the force, and I do this again, and I do this again, and I do this again. This method is called the Euler method, okay? And it's awful, and no one would use this for MD simulations, okay? It's very, very unstable. What we use for MD simulations, what's very popular in MD simulations, is called Verlet. And there's a trick that Verlet did. I hope I have the equation. I have to write it again. Again, sorry, Joe, I didn't write the equation here. So Verlet figured a very interesting trick. So you do a Taylor expansion of R at T, around R at T. Okay, so the top equation is an expansion forward in time, R at T plus delta. So you have R at T times the first derivative with respect to time, times delta t, so dot is derivative with respect to time, then the second derivative, then the third derivative, and the fourth derivative you approximate. So that equation is valid up to order 4 in delta t. And then the bottom equation is the same thing, but done to minus t, okay? So the genius here, okay, the magic is that if I add up these two equations, the third order term cancels. Right? So I have a fourth order accurate term without having to calculate third order derivatives. Does that make sense? Because they cancel out. So basically, I'm not going to do the sum in the interest of time so we can move, but with those two equations, if you add them up, you can predict R at T plus delta T if you know R at T, R dot, R double dot, that's the force, you know, it's acceleration. And the only price you pay for this is that you have to keep the positions, store the positions at t minus delta t. So you pay a little bit of a price in the memory implementation of your code because you have to store current positions and prior positions. But you get order 3, order 4 in your integration method. Okay, this is called Verlet. It's extremely popular in MD simulations. There are different flavors of it. There's velocity Verlet, leapfrog Verlet. They're all numerically identical. They just have different implementations, but they generate the same trajectory. The advantage of this is that these algorithms are, they have two important quantities. One is they're exactly reversible. Time reversible, okay? So if you move in time and then you reverse the arrow of time, you trace back your steps exactly, okay? Which these guys don't, right? This Euler is asymmetric, right? You move forward with the velocities and the force at the time, at the previous time. If you reverse, you're not going to go back because you have the forces at time t plus delta. And the other thing is that they conserve. They have a property that Hamiltonian systems have, which is that they conserve volume in phase space. And what the bottom line is that these techniques have very good long-term energy conservation, okay, because of this irreversibility. So you run this for a very, very long time, and you don't have little drifts. You don't accumulate errors that take energy from your system or give energy to your system slowly in time. They have very, very good low long-term drifts. This is very important because we're trying to do thermodynamics. You know, we're not NASA, right? We're not trying to put a ship on the moon. So I don't care about the specific trajectory. What I don't want to do is drift away from my thermodynamic surface because I'm trying to make a thermodynamic prediction. So if my energy is changing, then I'm exploring other spaces, other areas in thermodynamic space. All right. So that's how you integrate equations of motion. There are many other methods that are perfectly okay, but this Verlet family is particularly popular. Yes.
So what you showed is how to calculate t knowing the individual velocity. I want to start it. What do you mean continuation?
We'll get to that. So give me a, let me get there. Let's talk about forces, and then we're going to do a couple of runs, and we'll discuss these details, okay, how you set it up, what it means. As I said, with the forces is critical, right? If my forces between atoms are wrong, my melting temperature prediction is going to be wrong, the strength is going to be wrong, everything that I predict is going to be wrong. This is one of the two fundamental approximations, the other being classical mechanics. So, of course, the force can, you know, come from a potential. It could be from ab initio calculations, but we discussed that was expensive and would like to have something simpler. So, what is the simplest way in which, non-trivial way, in which we can write a potential like that? Okay? And this, if you think about it a little bit, the simplest way is to write the total energy as a sum of pairwise terms. Okay, you sum over pairs of atoms, and you have an interatomic potential that depends on the separation between atoms. Does that make sense? So if each of you look around their neighbors, and based on the distance, you say, okay, -2 with you, -3 with you, that's your potential. Okay? The shape of this function phi, you guys all have seen it. The way they look is something like that, okay? As you start with two atoms far away and you bring them closer and closer, the energy goes down first. That means that you make a bond. There's a minimum in energy at the equilibrium bond distance. And then the energy becomes repulsive. The energy goes up as you try to, you know, smash them together, okay? There are different functional forms that people use to describe this. You probably all heard of Leonard Jones. It's two power law curves, you know, of repulsion and attraction. There's also another one called exponential six of Buckingham. That's a combination. It's an exponential repulsion, power law attraction, and Moore's is two exponentials. Okay, and this is a comparison between Leonard Jones and Moore's. You see that they are very similar. You know, the differences between these things are not very fundamental. And you basically, with Leonard Jones, you have two free parameters. You have a distance scale and an energy scale. And with the other two, you have three parameters. So you have an energy scale, a distance curve, a distance scale, and a curvature at the bottom. So you can control those three things separately. Okay? So the distance, you would optimize to get a lattice parameter. Your energy, you would optimize to get cohesive energy for your solid. And the curvature, you'd optimize it to get the compressibility, the elastic constants of the solid. So there you have three parameters, you can fit three things, right? So these are very nice, computation very effective, efficient, but they're not very useful because they don't apply to most materials of interest, okay? They have a lot of limitations. The interaction between atoms is not pairwise, okay? The interaction between these two guys depends on whether I'm close or far away, okay? Because the interaction is done through the electrons. So if they're on their own, they're interacting whatever way they want between them. If I come along, they have to use some of their electrons to interact with me, and they will weaken their effective interaction, okay? So those are called many-body effects, and they result in all sorts of deviations between real materials and what you predict with pairwise potentials. Does that make sense? No matter what parameters you use for those pairwise potentials, you won't fix the fact that the interaction between two atoms is completely independent of a third atom coming in and trying to bond. Does that make sense? That leads to very, very clear challenges, okay? And I'm not going to go into the details, but these pair potentials basically only describe accurately noble gases, you know, things like argon and neon that interact through van der Waals interactions, no chemistry. So it's really a two-body interaction without sharing electrons and doing stuff like that. Now, they're very useful. We'll come back to them later on. Okay, for metals, there's a many-body potential, especially for simple metals, called EAM, Embedded Atom Model. Okay? And what EAM does is it adds to the two-body term, okay, it adds what's called an embedding energy. Okay? So that embedding energy is the term that's written in red. And what it does is, the way it works is, it's a sum over all the atoms of an embedding energy, which is a function of the local electronic density at that atom. Okay, that rho sub I. And rho sub I is calculated as, is a sum over the neighboring atoms of that atom I, which they all contribute their electronic densities. Okay? So the idea is that all the atoms contribute an electronic density. When you put an atom there, you have to add the energy required to embed the atom in the electronic density caused by the neighbors. Does that make sense? If that function F is not linear, that equation cannot be written as a sum of pairwise terms. Okay? So you have these many body effects, and this corrects a lot of the problems that you have with pairwise interactions. So, as I said, this is very good for, especially for FCC metals, gold, silver, nickel, a lot of the metals we're interested in. It's not very good when you have directional bonding, okay? When the bonding is strongly directional in terms of covalent bonds, because this is all centrosymmetric. The density doesn't have a direction, okay? A case that a lot of you who are interested in electronics would be very familiar with, where directional bonding is very important, is semiconductors, right? Open structures like diamond or zinc blend, where you have really, open structures, very far away from being close packed. Most metals have the coordination number. Each atom is surrounded by 12 neighbors, right? HCP and FCC. There are as many bonds as possible. Diamond is only 4, right? So it's very open structure with very few neighbors, very directional bonding. So a potential that's very widely used for this material is called Stillinger-Weber. Okay, a lot of you, if you've looked at MD simulations of these classes of systems, you've done Stillinger-Weber. As the other potential starts with a pairwise term, okay, sum over pairs of atoms of that, but in order to stabilize this open structure, if you only had two body interactions, there's no way you would stabilize diamond, right? Because you would have more atoms coming in to create more bonds to that structure. So in order to stabilize these open structures, what you have to do is add angular terms. Okay? So you have a term that penalizes any angle away from 109, from the tetrahedron angle. So then if you want to change, if you want to go from diamond to any other crystal structure, you'll have to modify the angles, and you would pay a penalty for doing that, okay? So in that way, you stabilize the structures that show this particular angle. And that tells you about the directionality of the bonds, that the bonds, that direction is important. This angle is important, right? It's not the same thing, any of these angles. Does that make sense? Okay. So, again, Stillinger-Weber, those are the functional forms. They're not important. But they are able to stabilize the diamond structure with respect to simple cubic FCC and BCC, right? This is what we were discussing before. When you parameterize the potential for diamond or for aluminum or whatnot, you make sure that the crystal structure that you want to stabilize is actually lower in energy than the other ones, okay? So this is energy as a function of density for the various different structures, right? You can see diamond is lower in energy than all the others for all lattice parameters, basically. Okay? Very quickly, molecular materials are slightly different from what we've been talking about, okay? So polymers, we're interested in polymers for packaging, we make entire planes out of polymer composites, right? The 787, the new plane coming from Boeing is entirely made of a carbon fiber composite. There's no, basically no aluminum in the plane at all. Okay, there's very little in the leading edges. So polymers are very important. They're becoming more important in many applications. And the way we describe polymers with molecular dynamics is you have the total potential energy has contributions from van der Waals. Okay, these are the non-bond interactions that we were talking about earlier. You have electrostatic interactions between atoms because atoms have partial charges. You know, the atoms are not neutral. There's a little bit of ionic bonding to these systems. And you also have a bunch of covalent terms that look kind of like what we described for silicon that describe the chemical bonding within the network, okay? So van der Waals, we've been talking about before, you know, these Lennard Jones, Morse, those two-body potentials describe very accurately van der Waals interactions that don't involve bonds, electrons sharing between atoms. There's some caveats in these potentials, but let's not get into it. Electrostatics, it's just Coulomb energy between the partial charges on the atoms, okay? So it's charge on one atom times the charge on the other divided by the separation between those two. Whenever you have Coulomb interactions, these are very long-range interactions. You have to be very careful how you do these sums when you have periodic boundary conditions, okay? These sums converge conditionally, even if the systems are charge neutral. Converging these sums with periodic boundary conditions is very challenging, and there are special techniques. So you probably heard of Ewald sums. There's a bunch of other techniques. You have to be very careful when you do long-range interactions with periodic boundary conditions in converging that 1 over r distance. So if you think about it, the interaction goes down with 1 over r, right? So if I'm a central atom, my influence on the rest of the world goes down with 1 over r. However, the number of atoms that are at distance r from me grow with r squared, right? If I'm in the bulk, the number of atoms that are at distance r from me go with the surface of the sphere if the density is constant, right? So the number of atoms grow with r squared. The interaction goes down with 1 over r. So overall, the farther you are, the more you contribute as a, you know, as a shell. Okay? So they're extremely difficult to converge. These are conditionally convergent sums. These are infinite sums that give you any value you want depending on how you order the terms, right? So when I was studying math as an undergraduate and I looked at that, that was complete magic to me, right? And this is a very clear example of why that happens. There are a couple of good papers if you're interested in learning more about long-range interactions, okay? Now, bonds very quickly, and then we'll do a demo and we'll call it a day. So to characterize bonded interactions, these are chemical bonds between atoms. You have what's called bond stretch. That's an energy as a function of the bond distance between atoms. You have angle terms like we discussed with silicon, okay? So water, the angle in water is 104, okay? That has to do with the orbitals and quantum mechanics. So you need to tell the force field that the angle has to be 104, and you have to tell how much energy it costs to move away from that equilibrium angle. So we do that with angle terms. And there's also torsional terms, which are four-body terms that tell you how hard it is to rotate a dihedral angle around a bond between two atoms. Ethylene and ethane are two examples, okay? As you try to flip the hydrogens on the sides in these two molecules, ethylene is very planar. And there's a huge energy barrier associated with rotating those two hydrogens because you have a double bond there between the carbons and you have to break the bond and form a new bond in order to rotate them around because they don't line up. In ethane, those hydrogens flip with no problem, basically no barrier, because it's a single bond between the carbon. So you have to be very careful with those type of things. But these things are well known, that they're well parameterized, and that's, those are the terms that you have in this type of of potentials, okay? There's a, here's a list, amber, driving, charm, compass, a list of papers, of force fields that are generally applicable to molecular materials, polymers and whatnot. Now, something exciting over the, maybe the last 10 years or so, maybe even less, is the development of reactive force fields, okay? Force fields that can break and form bonds like quantum mechanics can. And they're very interesting for many applications like interfaces, chemical reactions, explosives, whatnot. And the concept is, in those previous forces that I was telling you about for molecular materials, you have to predetermine the connectivity table. You have to say this atom is bonded to that atom and that atom is bonded to that guy. And so the force field can calculate the bonds and the angles and whatnot. And that cannot be rearranged during the run. You cannot break one of these bonds and form another. So there's a class of forces called reactive force fields that, instead of having a predetermined connectivity, they calculate the connectivity on the fly as you do dynamics. Okay? As you run molecular dynamics, it calculates the connectivity. And so it's using a concept that's called partial bond orders, where the configuration tells you about the bond order, and then the bond order between every pair of atoms tells you whether there's an actual bond or not a bond between any given pair of atoms, and then you use the potentials that way. So these are some of the key references for reactive potentials. And let me tell you a little bit about this potential, about this, because we've been talking about it. Let me skip through this. So if I do MD, if I solve F equals MA, we just saw that I conserve energy. The Hamiltonian is constant, right? That means that I'm living in the microcanonical ensemble, NVE ensemble. Now, most of the experiments we do are not isolated. They're not MV. They're NVT or NPT. Okay? So let's figure out how we do a simulation where we let the energy change or fluctuate and keep the temperature fixed. Okay? That's what I want to do. I want to keep the temperature constant, not the energy constant. So I want to start with F equals MA and think about how I can modify these equations so that I have constant temperature and not constant energy. Make sense? So one approach is to do this. So what if I add an additional force, okay, my force equation, an additional force that's proportional to negative the momentum, negative the velocity. What will happen if I do that? I'm sorry? It will decay, right? What I did is friction. I have an additional force that slows me down. Wherever I'm moving, it opposes my motion. So that's molecular dynamics with friction. Everything will come to a standstill, and I'm not, you know, this is an isothermal calculation, but only at zero temperature, which is not very useful. Right? Nothing moves. So a thermostat is doing this, but this variable, gamma, is not constant, like in friction. It's a function of whether your temperature, your local temperature at time t, is higher or lower than the temperature that you want to have. Okay? So if the system is too hot, you know, say you want to run 300 Kelvin, your system is at 400 Kelvin, you slow it down with this friction. But if your system goes down too much, you heat it up, you speed it up with anti-friction. You have a friction that has a negative coefficient, so it pushes it in the direction of the force. Does that make sense? So it's a very simple trick. It's very easy to implemented molecular dynamics, and it's called the Berenson thermostat. Okay? It's based on this idea of direct feedback. If you're too cold, I'm going to heat you up. If you're too hot, I'm going to cool you down. So the MD simulations converge to the temperature that you want. It's very efficient. The problem is you get the average temperature right, but you don't get the right fluctuations. Remember, we said that the fluctuations had to do with response functions. Fluctuations of energy at constant temperature have to do with specific heat. So you get the right average, but not the right distribution of states with the Berenson thermostat. Well, so there are more than one way. Okay, I'm going to tell you one. You're talking about Langevin dynamics. The approach I'm going to tell you about is Nose-Hoover. That's very widely used in MD. And it's very simple. What you do is integral feedback instead of direct feedback. So you have a very similar approach, but you have a heat flow variable. So it's not gamma that you determine. You determine gamma dot. So if you're too cold, you start moving in the direction of heating up, but you're not, you don't get direct feedback. Okay. You can show mathematically that this leads to the canonical ensemble. Okay? And, with the consequent pros, you know, you have the right fluctuations. Okay? And so, we run MD most of the time. If you're doing equilibrium simulations, you would run using the canonical ensemble. Okay. There's a bunch of papers, okay? So let me give you a few examples of our research, and we'll stop there because we've gone over the, we're very close to the limit. I can show you a tool that does MD simulations in a minute, but one of the things that you can do with this, again, the only approximation you're making is F equals MA and the potential, okay? So, for example, to look at heat transport in nanoscale, phonon heat, not electronic transport, phonon heat transport in nanoscale material, it's an ideal tool because interfaces, boundaries, surfaces are described explicitly. You don't make any approximations as to whether they're scattering, which phonon does what. All the, every single atom is there, right? So your phonons are described for free. So one way to do temperature heat transport calculations via non-equilibrium simulations, where you move heat from one part of your system to the to another part, you create a steady state temperature profile. You know your heat, you know your temperature profile. You can measure, you can calculate thermal conductivity. So let me give you some examples. So this is for silicon and germanium. What I'm showing here, this is work of my, one of my grad students, is inverse heat conductivity, so heat resistivity, it's a function of inverse size, okay? And what you see is that naturally, you get this size dependence on the thermal conductivity, right? You make a big system, okay, that's to the left, you get a high thermal conductivity, low resistivity. You make a smaller system, you get a lower thermal conductivity. And that's because of this, the ballistic effect, right? That the mean, the phonon mean free path gets in the way with the size of your system. Your system gets in the way with the phonon mean free path, and the effective mean free path goes down. So from this type of simulations, you can get, you can extrapolate to bulk, and you can get the mean free path of the phonons. This compares the numbers in red, compares the bulk thermal conductivity in experiments with our predictions for silicon and germanium. This is with Stillinger-Weber potentials like we described, and mean free path. And the bottom line is we're actually very accurately, okay, we provide very accurate simulations. This is for bulk. Then we looked at a bunch of laminates, okay, silicon-germanium laminates, both in the bulk and for wires, nanowire laminates, okay? And again, there's no input. So the bulk thermal conductivity of silicon, we and germanium, you know, they're in the hundreds of watts per meter Kelvin. When we make these laminates, okay, the red line there, this is the conductivity as a function of the period of the laminate. So these are nanometer size periods. And the red line, I'm sorry, the green line is our prediction on the left. And the red and the blue points are experimental data. Okay? So we went from 100 plus for the bulk to 2 or so in these laminates. And the theory, with no input from experiments, no fitting parameters whatsoever, captures this gigantic change in the thermal conductivity. Okay? It's very impressive that you have that level of capability to predict stuff. Now, and so what you see also is that, and this is well known, is that as you make your period, your nanolaminate period smaller and smaller and smaller, at the beginning, the thermal conductivity goes down because you have more interfaces. But there comes a point where your period is so small that the phonons see you as a homogeneous material. And so for very, very small periods, the thermal conductivity shoots back up and your material conducts very well. Okay? So there's an optimal period if you want to have a low thermal conductivity material. There's some unexpected results that we're trying to understand, that the wires conduct better than our laminates. You know, you would expect the nanowire because of, if you have bulk, the nanowire conducts a lot worse than the bulk system, okay? Because of surface scattering. If we take a nanolaminate and a wire with the same laminate, the wire conducts better, okay? And we know that the origin has to do with the interfaces, but we're not entirely sure where it comes from. The interface of the wires are not as good at scattering as the interfaces in the flat, you know, 2D laminates. Okay. I'll stop there. These are other examples of our research. Alright, so, and this is a page we put together on MD, okay, so, topics, nanohab.org topics MD, and that has a bunch of additional links to, we have a 6-lecture short course on MD or 7-lecture short course with a tutorial with the nanohab tool that takes everything we talked about today and explains it reasonably well, a little bit better. It has links to online tools. That's links to offline tools, books, and other stuff. So, again, if you have suggestions, comments, if you have questions, feel free to email me after this. I'm here this week. And if you're interested in a postdoc or you have friends who are interested in a postdocs, let us know. All right, thank you. Questions? Yeah. Come again?
Let's say I would like to find the Ring's modulus of my material. So we select a small sample of the material and do the MD and assume that that is the Ring's modulus of the entire material.
Right. So that's a very good question. So like in ab initio calculations, if you're interested in bulk property, you use periodic boundary conditions. So you take a small sample, but you know, whatever number of atoms, maybe 10,000 or 100,000, but you don't put free boundaries on it. You put periodic boundary conditions, and then you apply your deformation, your boundary conditions of deforming in one direction, letting it contract in the other too. And that is a much better description of the bulk than if you have a tiny sample with lots of free surface. Now, something you can also get from MD is the Young's modulus of a small nanowire that will be affected by these surface processes. That will be slightly different from the bulk. You know, you can see size effects on those properties. Make sense?
So what if it is not isotropic properties?
No, they're not. I mean, so obviously elasticity is not isotropic. And if you put every single atom there and you pull it in one direction or pulling in the other direction, you're going to get different numbers. So you get the entire elastic constant tensor from the simulations. Yeah.
You talked about the Lagrange range interaction. I didn't understand it very well. Can you explain it a little more?
Yeah, so the challenge is this. So we have van der Waals, okay? The attractive interaction goes down with 1 over r to the power 6, okay? That means that it goes down very quickly. Now, Coulomb goes with 1 over r, okay? So let's say I'm calculating the energy of me with respect to all the atoms in the rest of the system. And I have a very big system. So if you calculate my interaction with the first shell, you get a number. Then you go further and the interaction goes down with 1 over r. But the number of atoms at that next shell goes up with r squared, right? So the interaction is basically r squared divided by r to the n, right? So for Leonard Jones, this is 6. So that means that the overall energy goes down very quickly as I move away from the central atom. So I can use a cutoff. You know, I count a few and then I ignore the rest. It's not a big deal. But if this is 1, it's never, it gets worse and worse and worse. And that's why you have to use special sum techniques. And the bottom line is, well, some of these techniques, you do part of the calculation of reciprocal space. So things that move very slowly in real space are easy to handle in reciprocal space. That's kind of the trick. But there are others. You know, they're not all like, does that make sense? So. Yep. I'm sorry?
There has been some confusion about the exact nature of van der Waals forces in structured nanomaterials. Could MV give a more, say, different direction to get that?
So I'm not sure. I mean, what's the challenge? I'm not sure I understand the question.
So if we have two perfect other planes, Casimir or
Van der Waals, sure, yeah. Yes. Yes.
But if it has...
No, I understand. Yeah.
This controversy
was
the nature of the
forces. Yeah, so in principle you can. That's actually something we've been working on. We've been working on contacts. If you see some of these simulations, we've done some very large-scale in these simulations. We have a couple of papers out on looking at contacts and looking at what happens when you bring two rough surfaces together. Now, so MD, in principle, they're very expensive things to do because you have to sum this 1 over r to the 6 equations up to very long distances. But if you're interested in Casimir versus your retarded van der Waals versus regular van der Waals, MD might help you do an MD tool might help you do a brute force calculation. You know, you can code this in and do a calculation, but it's not going to give you the answer directly. Yep.
I got a question. You introduced several approaches among them, Berendian approach and Nozick-Hoover.
Yes.
And what is the difference? I didn't understand.
Yeah, so...
The new parameter.
Yeah. Let me show you the difference. So... both of these things are thermostats, okay? So, Berendsen is on the left. It's called direct feedback, okay? What it means is, see that gamma number? If your system is too hot, you're going to put friction. So gamma is going to be positive, and you're going to slow it down. If the system is too cold, gamma is going to be negative, and you're going to be heating up the system. And that is to keep your average kinetic energy corresponding to whatever temperature you want to have in your system. And you do it through a direct feedback mechanism. Okay, that's Berenson. Nosse-Hoover uses a very similar approach, but if you see the last equation for Nosse-Hoover, it's gamma dot, not gamma. Okay? So if your temperature is, the temperature of your system is too hot, what will happen is gamma will start moving in the direction in which it will eventually take energy from the system and cool it down. So it's indirect feedback. It's integral feedback. Okay? As opposed to direct feedback. And you can do a little bit of math that I haven't shown, and you can show that the equations of motion on the left lead to the canonical distribution, lead to a probability of e to the negative beta energy over kt.
Which is Berenson.
No, Nosse-Hoover, the one on the right. I'm sorry. So the one on the right leads to the canonical distribution. So both of those lead to the same average kinetic energy. Okay? So I've run two runs, and the kinetic energies in average are the same. But the fluctuations of one is this, and the other one is this. The fluctuations of the one with Nosse-Hoover are the fluctuations that you would expect in the canonical ensemble from statistical mechanics. In Berenson, they're not. Okay, so you get the right mean values, but not the right distribution of energies.
What about the denominator? It's just, we see it is...
That is the temperature you want to have. In this
independence on time.
No. So I know I went through this very quickly. So when you thermodynamically, temperature is a constant, okay? Or it's very, very slowly varying function of time. So that's your target temperature. Okay, the temperature of your thermostat you want to run at 300 Kelvin. That's T on the left, it should be T naught, it's T naught on the right. I'm sorry. T on the right, T naught on the left. That's the desired temperature. That's the temperature of the heat path in which your system lives. The temperature's function of time, that's the instantaneous temperature of the system. It's called kinetic temperature. It's the kinetic energy at that particular time translated into temperature. The thermodynamic temperature of your system is the long time average of that T of T. Okay? So your kinetic energy fluctuates, your temperature is associated with the mean value of that kinetic energy.
So it is T independence on time, not T0?
T0 is not dependent of time. That's the temperature, the equilibrium temperature that you want to have in your simulation.
I just wanted to say that if the denominator will not depend on time, just they put T independence on time. Not T0 in the denominator.
In the denominator is T0, it's constant. For Nosse-Hoover. That T is the temperature you want to run at. And the other one is the fluctuating one. It's the instantaneous one.
So we can challenge that one. We can select different shapes, and for example, quadratic. As you know, if the velocity is pretty increased, and we can, the friction is depends on v squared, not v, as here, for example.
So what friction depends on v squared?
The friction here depends on p.
Right.
But on increased, when the velocity is increased, the friction depends as p squared.
So under what circumstance?
I think in mechanics it is used like that.
Right.
So you can look for two cases when friction depends as v or friction depends on v squared.
Right.
I think there is a lot of challenge, a lot of work can be done here.
So maybe. Now, what you need to understand is this is a completely artificial friction, right? These are atoms. have every single atom. The atom is not moving through a fluid. It's not dragging through a surface. It's just an atom. This artificial friction is just a way of giving energy to the system and taking energy away from the system. Maybe there's something about putting a V-square term. I don't know. I've done some work on this, you know, some research on this myself. So maybe there's something there, I'm not sure. But this is not trying to mimic real friction as in, you know, mechanical friction. The atoms, they're not really moving through a fluid or interacting with anything else, just a way of controlling the temperature through an artificial coupling to the system. And the goal is that all of these are weak enough that you don't distort the dynamics, but you slowly take it to the temperature that the system wants to have, that you want the system to have. It's the same thing as you're running your experiment, you put it at some temperature, the nature of the furnace that you're using to take the system to that temperature is probably not very relevant. You know, whether it's a radiation or whether it's whatever. So it's supposed to be a way to take the system to some equilibrium state. All right. Okay.
So one idea is to find the temperature, microscopic temperature, by using the equipartition theorem idea. So that temperature is the average temperature across the entire sample you have, right?
Yeah, so the thermodynamic temperature is the time average of the temperature that you have,
so
correct.
Is there a way that we can get some spatial distribution?
Yes. When we do the thermal transport, we do that. We do local averages over different regions in space, and you get a temperature gradient. Absolutely.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for a terrific session.
Thank you. All right. So nice questions, nice discussions. So I enjoyed it.